Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this frigid day, joining us with undoubtedly hot analysis, Christopher Larimer. Chris is professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, glad to be here.
Evan Renfro with us, assistant professor of political science also at the University of Northern Iowa. Evan, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
And not in studio today, tucked away at your respective homes. We're glad you're out of the cold, even though we're up from minus 20-something into the teens, it seems, around most of the state. Join our conversation this hour. We're going to be talking about a number of things. Later in the hour, Kamala Harris's first visit to Iowa as a 2020 candidate. Also, we'll talk about the former Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz, saying he's seriously considering a White House bid. Afghanistan, the U.S. looking for a way out there, and also an update, as is usual, on the new developments in the Russia investigation. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Gentlemen, let's first talk about this remarkable testimony yesterday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. We had our top intelligence officials detailing the biggest threats facing the U.S. And Evan, I'm going to be leaning, we're going to be leaning especially on your credentials. I want to mention that you're a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst and a senior civilian intelligence analyst, and now a political scientist, of course, at the University of Northern Iowa. But that background comes in especially handy when we talk about the threats outlined. We had, you know, cyber attacks from Russia, China, the Islamic State was discussed. One of the main takeaways from the briefing by the intelligence chiefs were that these priorities outlined by the intelligence chiefs are at odds with the president's. Let's listen to one of the clips. This is Dan Coats, a national intelligence director, detailing the current threats posed to the United States, some of which appear, as I said, to be at odds with the existing U.S. policy. He says they expect more unrest in Iran in the coming months and that Tehran continues to sponsor terrorism.
We expect Iran will continue supporting the Houthis in Yemen and Shia militants in Iraq while developing indigenous military capabilities that threaten U.S. forces and allies in the region. Iran maintains the largest inventory of ballistic missiles in the Middle East. And while we do not believe Iran is currently undertaking activities we judge necessary to produce a nuclear device, Iranian officials have publicly threatened to push the boundaries of JCPOA restrictions if Iran does not gain the tangible financial benefits it expected from the deal.
Okay, Dan Coats, National Intelligence Director, yesterday. I see, before I have you respond, Evan, I don't know if you saw the latest news within the last few minutes. The president chastising these intelligence officials today in a couple of tweets. Let me just read the two tweets together. From the president, the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They are wrong. When I became president, Iran was making trouble all over the Middle East and beyond. Since ending the terrible Iran nuclear deal, they are much different, but a source of potential danger and conflict. They are testing rockets, last week in parentheses, and more, and are coming very close to the edge. Their economy is now crashing, which is the only thing holding them back. Be careful of Iran. Perhaps intelligence should go back to school, says the president. Evan Renfro, what do you make of it?
Well, you know, as usual, there's a lot to unpack here. I would start with the testimony of these intelligence leaders, all of whom, it's worth remembering, are Republicans and Republican-appointed Trump administration officials. The testimony, remarkable precisely because it flatly contradicts on virtually every major policy issue the president's own inclination, starting with Iran. So you have to separate two issues when it comes to Iran. One is the nuclear missile component. The other is being a bad actor in the region. President Obama's primary strategic security concern was in preventing the Iranian regime from obtaining nuclear missiles capability. That has been accomplished. They are in compliance with that original agreement that President Trump has taken the U.S. out of, although our EU allies have stuck with it because, again, Iran is, by all accounts, in compliance with that portion of it. What the portion did not deal with, precisely because the president, President Obama, wanted to, again, focus on that nuclear missile component, is its other ballistic missiles, short-range and intermediate ballistic missiles, and Iran's penchant for causing trouble in the region, particularly here with the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, which tend to be contrary to U.S. security interests in the region. So once you separate these sort of policies out, then you can see where the disagreement comes from. Now, we can go on and talk about Afghanistan, Russia, and the other ones, but I wanted to at least tackle that one first.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we had North Korea in the mix, too, that the North Koreans are, I guess, according to our intelligence officials, unlikely to completely abandon their nuclear stockpile, right?
Right, right. And so with North Korea, you see sort of the flip of this, whereas President Trump maintains that, oh, there's not too much to be concerned with anymore. The intelligence community assesses that North Korea is not in compliance with its nuclear missiles program at this time. So they have continued to covertly maintain their missile capability, which is indeed a threat to the United States. But for whatever reason, the president at this time does not accept that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that we have, I guess, the divide. Would it be fair to say the divide between this administration and the Republican leaders in Congress is growing here in foreign policy? For instance, yesterday, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, introduced a measure denouncing what is called the precipitous withdrawal of American troops from Syria and Afghanistan. And this is something the president ordered last month. Evan, comment on that divide between the Trump administration and the Republican establishment on these key foreign policy threats abroad.
Right, and of course the president's order to withdraw precipitously from Syria was the impetus of Secretary Mattis resigning as Secretary of Defense. But note, you'll see that U.S. military presence is still in Syria, just as it was a month ago. The key here is the president's claim that ISIS is no longer a threat. Mm-hmm. We have to unpack this. While it is demonstrably true that ISIS controls far less territory than it did in its heyday in within the borders of Syria and Iraq, it's also true that, you know, you have to look at this group as a mentality or an ideology, and it spreads. And so while it controls much, much less territory, it still poses a crucial threat to the U.S. and its allies, because the fear is as soon as you leave, it gives them an opportunity to regroup. Okay, now when it comes to Afghanistan, you're dealing with a different can of worms altogether, where the U.S. envoy there, Khalid, is making deals with the old boss of the Taliban, recently released by Pakistan, Mullah Baradar, who, basically the agreement here is with the Taliban, the U.S. saying U.S. will leave, all military forces will leave, and you, Taliban, promise not to allow terrorists to operate on your soil. Mm-hmm. Which is what got the Taliban in trouble to begin with 9/11. You have to distinguish the Taliban from al-Qaeda.
But to jump in there, isn't the Taliban likely to agree to anything? Once the U.S. troops, the U.S. military is out, they know it's very hard for the U.S. to bring them back after 17 years of war. So once the U.S. troops is gone, aren't you just handing the country back to these ruthless militants that we went to war against after 9/11?
Well, they certainly are ruthless. However, the Taliban have never... Their agenda is not exporting terrorism. Their agenda is to control Afghanistan. Now, do they treat the people in Afghanistan in terrible and miserable conditions? Yes. But again, the U.S. didn't have a problem with that until after, until after 9/11, when it became clear that they were allowing terrorist networks like al-Qaeda. Now, could they promise anything and then do whatever they wanted once the U.S. left? That, of course, is the fear. However, as Gina Haspel testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee, you've got to have some sort of robust architecture in place involving intelligence, and you know, you can certainly have a it doesn't take many special operation style forces. You know, you think about Delta forces or SEALs that can be deployed, and you have satellites, you have drones, where you would pretty effectively notice if terrorist training camps were being rebuilt. And then what you would do is you would take those camps out. You don't need a presence of 14,000 plus U.S. troops in order to accomplish that limited objective. You do need a heavy footprint if your objective is to build a civil society with democratic norms in Afghanistan, which has been what the U.S. has been trying to do for the last 17 years.
Okay. Evan Renfro is with us, a political scientist at the University of Northern Iowa. Chris Larimer as well at UNI. Evan, I want to mention again, he's a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst. We want to move on. We have so much to cover, but let's talk with Troy in Iowa City calling in. Thanks for calling in. Before we move on, Troy, let's get your comment. Welcome.
Yes. Didn't the Obama administration pull out troops from Iraq, and that caused a big problem, and they took over 90% of Iraq? And also, didn't Obama give Iran approximately $20 billion to $100 billion back?
Troy, thanks, in Iowa City. Evan?
Yeah, so certainly the president campaigned on, was elected on the platform of drawing down U.S. forces in Iraq. He did draw down U.S. forces in Iraq. Of course, there's always been, U.S. forces in Iraq still. You just reduced the size a great deal. And it did, in many ways, it created a situation that so that these bad actors could reorganize themselves. The same fear that allows for the argument about not to do that this time in Syria. As far as the money to Iran, you have to remember that was, in fact, Iranian money that had been frozen by the U.S. Because of what happened in 1979. And as part of the deal, they were to get their money back. That is, that those frozen accounts were thawed.
Okay. Evan Renfro with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Chris Larimer of UNI as well on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the caucus campaign season heating up. Kamala Harris with her first visit to Iowa. We also had the former CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, talking about how he may be considering to run as a centrist independent in 2020. We'll get our analysts' comments after that. Let's move on to, if you'd like to join our conversation, if you don't have our telephone noted or on your fridge, it should be on your fridge, by the way, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee postponing a vote on the president's attorney general nominee, William Barr. I guess Democrats expressing concern that he might not make a public final, make public a final report on the special counsel's Russia investigation. Chris, perhaps you can handle this and talk a little bit about this delay, giving the Democrats a little more time, right?
That's right. Yeah. So the concern here is that the nominee, William Barr, as you mentioned, has come out in the past saying, being critical of the Mueller investigation. And so now there's this delay on the vote because there's a concern about whether or not the findings from that investigation will be made public, given Barr's past comments criticizing the intent of the investigation. And so this does give Democrats a little bit more time. I still think, at this point, obviously Republicans control the U.S. Senate, which means they have the majority on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's going to probably be voted out of that committee. He will be confirmed in the Senate. It's just that now you have a little bit more time where those criticisms are going to be made more public. This also, of course, means that the interim attorney general or the acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, who, of course, played football at the University of Iowa, will continue to be the acting attorney general may end up being the acting attorney general when that Mueller investigation is finally released. So there's still quite a bit of politicking going on related to the nomination, as well as to the Mueller investigation itself.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to something that Matt Whitaker made the news with. I guess he was actually the focus of his press opportunity was something else, but he chose to speak about the Mueller investigation on Monday, telling reporters that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in 2016, the election, is close to being completed. Evan and Chris, listen to this. It's not entirely clear to me, at least, what the message that Matt Whitaker wanted to get out. Let's listen.
You know, I've been fully briefed on the investigation, and, you know, I look forward to Director Mueller delivering the final report. And I really am not going to talk about open and ongoing investigation otherwise, but, you know, sort of the statements that I made were as a private citizen, only with publicly available information. I am comfortable that the decisions that were made are going to be reviewed, either through the various means we have. But right now, you know, the investigation is, close to being completed. And I hope that we can get the report from Director Mueller as soon as possible.
Chris Larimer, what do you decipher from that?
Well, he either knows a lot or is kind of, you know, hinting that he knows more, or it's a little bit confusing because I think, you know, the entire public, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent, has been waiting for these results and wants to see the results from the Mueller investigation. If the acting attorney general Whitaker is saying that he's just relying on public statements and he's seeing that the Mueller investigation is close to being complete, it would be nice to know what statements he's seen, because I think most of the public statements, that at least that I've seen, are that this is still very much ongoing. I haven't seen anything to hint that this is close to being done. It may be, but I haven't seen anything in public that's suggesting that. So I don't know if he's talking about something else or other conversations he's had. I think, like I said, though, politically, what's interesting is that whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or an independent, you want these results out. And this has been a long investigation. Everybody is anxious for their own reasons to see what the results are, because every week there is a new finding, something new public comes out. You know, someone else is indicted, someone else is being investigated. So I think the anxiety surrounding the investigation itself is kind of almost at a peak at this point.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro, did you learn anything from Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker's comments there?
Well, how to produce a nebulous statement, I suppose. He starts out, you know, he's been fully briefed, he says, and he wants us to know that the statements he has made in the past were based on, you know, just general publicly accessible news items. And then he says, sort of this arcane or esoteric comment about, we'll review those decisions once everything's out. Now, it's unclear what decisions he's talking about reviewing, or what the, you know, he mentions various mechanisms for reviewing those decisions, but it's not at all clear, you know, what those decisions involve. Does that mean his comments, he would edit those comments based on new evidence, or what? So I'm not sure exactly what was going on there.
To pick up the last few minutes before our break, continuing with the Russia investigation, the president's former fixer and an attorney, Michael Cohen, will now testify before the House Intelligence Committee next week. On Monday, Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, he's also the chair of the panel, said Cohen agreed to appear voluntarily before the committee behind closed doors on February 8th. Now, last week, Cohen had backed out of some planned public testimony in front of the House Oversight Committee. He cited fears for his family's safety after Trump and his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, publicly criticized Cohen and his father-in-law. How does Michael Cohen's, Chris, how does Michael Cohen's testimony fit into the Mueller investigation? This thing has so many arms and legs. Where does Michael Cohen fit?
Well, I think the key part of this, obviously, is that he was the president's lawyer. And so I think as a witness going to testify before the committee, this is going to be one of the main events of the Mueller investigation, because this is someone who is intimately tied to the president as his personal lawyer. And then in terms of the investigation itself, there are a couple of different things going on here. One, there are campaign finance-related violations
in terms of payments made to women using potentially campaign money that the president allegedly lied about. And then in terms of the Mueller investigation, there is the ongoing investigation about the development of a Trump Tower in Moscow and how long were those conversations going on during the campaign. You know, we heard Rudy Giuliani talking last week about those investigations. Rudy Giuliani is obviously now on the president's legal team, but talking that those investigations initially maybe stopped in January of 2016, and then later on saying that, well, maybe they went into October or November of 2016. Did they go beyond that? And if they went beyond that, what does that mean if you have a president talking about, you know, personal finances, trying to benefit personally from business developments with Moscow after he's been elected president or sworn into office? And so I think, you know, the Cohen testimony is, I think the idea behind that is going to shed a little bit more light on that, on when those conversations were going on, for how long, and with whom.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention another development, a bipartisan pair of lawmakers, including Senator Chuck Grassley, also Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, introducing legislation this week that would require Mueller or any other Justice Department special counsel to turn over a report to Congress once the investigation ends, or if they are removed or fired. An unclassified version of the report would, under this legislation, be publicly released. Evan, we have a large number of indictments, a whole mound of them, plea deals, court filings, a trial, convictions of people around the president. There is that key question. Was there a criminal conspiracy by members of Trump's team to cooperate with Moscow's bid to make him president? Are we any closer in the last few days to having an answer to that question?
Well, I don't know, but I bet you that Mueller does. And that's the type of thing that we'll just have to find out. You know, going back to Cohen, it is unfortunate for those of us that are curious about this that he's not, after all, testifying in a public venue. He was going to, but then I guess due to threats stated or implied, he decided maybe that's not the best idea. So now it's a closed-door scenario. This legislation that would demand a report in case something happened to Mueller is probably a good idea, something like a doomsday device to where even if Mueller gets fired, that report is going to be made manifest somehow. At least it would go to Congress. Now, it's an open question. It's an open question as to whether or not they would release it in full to the public.
Okay, Evan Renfro with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Chris Larimer with us as well, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. When we come back, that 35-day shutdown, partial shutdown, ended last week, but we have a possibility of another shutdown looming in about 3 weeks. We'll talk about it, what needs to happen to avoid that shutdown when we come back. Join us with your thoughts on that, as well as the beginning of the caucus campaign season. I'm Ben Kiefer with Evan Renfro and Chris Larimer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
And we're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and his colleague Evan Renfro, both political scientists at UNI in Cedar Falls, joining us by phone today, keeping the two of them out of the horrible cold that we have. And hope you're staying warm by your radio or wherever you are. As we talk about politics of recent days on Politics Wednesday. Well, the 35-day government shutdown that ended last week, well, we have the possibility of another shutdown coming in 3 weeks. Finally ended late Friday when the White House and congressional leaders struck a deal to reopen the government through February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day. It's an agreement that contained no new money for a border wall, but it did call for bipartisan conference committee to spend the next 3 weeks negotiating ways to secure the southern border. In our news update there from Dennis, we heard that Congress is active in looking at ways of not having the shutdown repeat in a different way. Let's listen a little bit to Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, speaking yesterday regarding the end of the partial government shutdown.
I hope this serves as a lesson to President Trump and all of my Republican colleagues. No more shutdown. President Trump touched a hot, hot stove, and hopefully he won't do it again. The conference committee we suggested as a way out of the Trump shutdown permanently begins tomorrow. The House and Senate should strive to find common ground and build from there. Democrats and Republicans agree on the need for stronger border security measures at our ports of entry to stop illegal drugs, as well as humanitarian assistance, and those are good places to start. We've come to big agreements before, for example, on budgets and Russian sanctions. What was the common theme? When the president stays out of the negotiations, we almost always succeed.
Chuck Schumer commenting yesterday. Chris Larimer, have lessons been learned?
That's really hard to say. I was just reading something earlier this week noting that since 1976, this is the 21st government shutdown that we've had. So it's hard to know if lessons have been learned. I mean, unfortunately, even if you look back just to 2000, the theme regarding the federal budget is that we have about 6 to 7 continuing resolutions every year. Mm-hmm. The federal budget process itself is basically broken at this point. It doesn't operate the way it's supposed to in terms of the regular timetable where the president submits, you know, his or her budget. First week of February, the House and the Senate come up with budget resolutions that they agree on for overall spending levels. That really hasn't worked. I mean, you think back to the last few shutdowns, the debt ceiling crisis going back to 2011. You know, it's hard to know if lessons have been learned. I mean, I think at this point, looking ahead to February 15th, my guess would be that they try to get that Congress does try to come to some sort of agreement that probably does not include a wall, but includes more money for border security, because it's clear that public opinion is not on the side of the wall, and it's not on the side of more government shutdown. You know, the poll after poll in the last couple of weeks has shown that, you know, the public generally blames the president and Republicans in Congress for the shutdown. So, you know, public opinion is not on their side. And for the most part, the public really doesn't see a need for a border wall, let alone to shut down the government over a border wall. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that they probably are going to get something done. I just don't know if the lesson has been learned. The federal budget process has become so political. Like I said, it's completely broken in terms of the way it operates. It's basically we get up to the end of the fiscal year every September 30th, neither side has agreed to some portion of the budget. And then we're in the process of just one continuing resolution after another to finish out each fiscal year.
Right. We had this news today of the, 19 rookie Democrats in the U.S. House co-sponsoring a bill. These are Democrats, including Iowa's two congresswomen, Abby Finkenauer and Cindy Axne, co-sponsoring a bill that would set up a system to prevent future government shutdowns called the Shutdown to End All Shutdowns Act. One part of this, Congress, the president, anyone the president appoints to the federal government would not be paid in a shutdown if the bill becomes law. Evan, I have to believe that would be so popular, especially among those 800,000 who went without a paycheck.
Yeah, this is really destabilizing and very costly in terms of revenue. But I would say, just back to our initial conversation about the intelligence chief's testimony to the Senate the other day, this border security concern was nowhere near the top of the list. This was, I think, page 18. It took 18 pages out of a 40-page report to even mention anything to do with Mexico. So there are real concerns out there involving North Korea, China, Russia, ISIS, you name it. But this is just not a substantial security threat in the view of U.S. intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Evan, do you see any lasting impact of this historic shutdown? Repercussions?
Oh, you know, it's hard to, you know, like Chris was saying, it's hard to say what the lasting impact. It could be one of these type deals that everything gets fixed and we never have to deal with this sort of thing again. That might be wishful thinking. It's too hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
If I can jump in here on this, Ben, there was a column in PA Times, which is Public Administration Times, put out by the American Society for Public Administration. And Alan Rosenbaum, who's a very well-known public administration scholar, was talking about these long-term effects and basically talking about what effect is this going to have on a new generation of workers. In other words, they're coming of age when they basically see that the government does not work. It doesn't work properly in terms of the budget process. It continues to be shut down. How much, what effect is this going to have on people's trust in government generally and their likelihood of a younger population, say those students who are 18 to 24-year-olds, what are they going to look at employment in the public sector? What are they going to think of it, right? We already know that there are popular perceptions out there of working in government that, you know, we, Evan and I, work on as professors to try to overcome that, you know, work in government is innovative, it is creative, it is a good job. But then you see on TV the government shut down 35 days over something that is an extremely small portion of the overall budget, and there's a concern that long term people are just going to be less likely to trust government, less likely to even think about going to work in government.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones. Chris Larimer with us, Evan Renfro, two political scientists from the University of Northern Iowa. Mary joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's a book out by David K. Johnston, The Making of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump has no respect for salaried workers. From the time of the Bonwood building, where they had to tear it down to build the tower, down to Atlantic City, every salaried worker had to sue Donald Trump for their pay, for their the pay that was owed to him. So this shutdown is peculiar to Trump, and it was more than 800,000 people affected. If you extrapolate out to their families, they had children, they had obligations, they
yes,
had
they
bills
did.
To pay. So it's on Trump, and we're sitting, and then he only respects Ingram and Rush Limbaugh, and it's 350 million Americans. What about the rest of us? See, this hasn't been examined as closely as it should.
Mm-hmm.
And my final thing is, doesn't he think that North Korea is looking at Venezuela? And we're back to gunboat diplomacy. And I'm glad you have that man who was intelligence so that he could tell us more about this.
Right. Mary, thank you very much for your comments from Iowa City. A lot to unpack there. David K. Johnston, you mentioned there, Mary, he was actually on this program for a full hour. You mentioned his book, his biography of Donald Trump before the Donald Trump was nominated by the Republicans to be the presidential nominee. Let's talk a little bit, if we could, Chris, dive more into your area. We had Republicans in the Iowa House of Representatives voting this week not to count 29 mail-in ballots in a Northeast Iowa State House race. There's a little bit of a story behind it. I wonder if you'd offer your thoughts.
Sure. So this is the story comes from the House District 55, as you said, up in Northeast Iowa. I think it's Clayton, Fayette, and portions of Winnesheet counties up in Northeast Iowa. And it was a race between the incumbent Michael Bergen and the Democratic challenger, Kayla Kepler. Excuse me. And it was a race where about 14,000 votes were cast, but it came down to 9 votes in the end. And Bergen won by 9 votes. There was a challenge by Kessler on this because initially there were 33 ballots, that absentee ballots that came in that were not postmarked, and she wanted those challenged to say that they should count for the election. There was a thought that those ballots, since they had come in, were mailed by Monday before the election, which is legal under Iowa code, as long as they were mailed by then, postmarked by then, that they should count for the election. Well, the 33 were not postmarked. But the U.S. Postal Service went back and used barcode information on those ballots to say that at least 29 of them would have been mailed by Monday of prior to the election. The issue here, though, is it really gets down to barcodes, essentially. Iowa allows the use of what they call intelligent barcodes that counties, if they want to work with the Postal Service, can ask that all absentee ballots have an intelligent barcode placed on the absentee ballot so that if it's not postmarked, because not all mail is postmarked, they can use that barcode to look up to see when the ballot was sent out. In this case, these weren't intelligent barcodes, but they were barcodes that nonetheless, my understanding, at least as I've tried to read up on this, is that those barcodes were enough, at least for the U.S. Postal Service, to determine that they had been mailed by Monday prior to the election. The Iowa House, there was a 5-member committee in the Iowa House that looked at this and said that, according to Iowa code, that these ballots should not be counted because they did not have postmark and they did not have that intelligent barcode, as they call it. And then it went to the full House, and the Iowa House also voted that down, saying that those ballots, those 29 ballots, should not be counted. And so that's what happened just this last week. And so it continues to be this ongoing process, but it initially a very close election, down to 9 votes, challenged in court. Initially a recount requested, then challenged in court, and then you have a 5-member committee in the Iowa House, and now that full House voting to say that the Republican Michael Bergen should be the office holder for this particular district. But as I've looked it up and tried to follow it, it does seem to come down to those barcodes on the ballots. And as I said, my understanding of Iowa law at this point is that it's really up to individual county auditors, if they want to start that process with the Postal Service, to implement those intelligent barcodes for all absentee ballots, because it does take time.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer with us, Evan Renfro, our political scientist from the University of Northern Iowa, on this Politics Wednesday. Let's talk about the caucus season stretching out before us, mm-hmm. many months yet of that before the February 3rd, 2020 date of the Iowa caucuses. Kamala Harris has made her first visit as a 2020 candidate to the state earlier this week at a town hall in Des Moines, broadcast by CNN. California Senator Kamala Harris endorsed the Green New Deal, I guess it's called, a plan to eventually have 100% of U.S. electricity from renewable energy. She also supported a ban on automatic assault weapons and vied for Medicare for all. Let's listen.
I believe the solution, and I'm actually feel very strongly about this, is that we need to have Medicare for all. That's just the bottom line. And I'll say this, and this is, I think, why you're also asking this question. What we know is that to live in a civil society, to be true to the ideals and the spirit of who we say we are as a country, we have to appreciate and understand that access to health care it should not be thought of as a privilege. It should be understood to be a right. It should be understood to be something that all people should be entitled to so that they can live a productive life, so they can have dignity. And having a system that makes a difference in terms of who receives what based on your income is unconscionable, it is cruel, and in many situations that I have witnessed, inhumane.
So, Chris, how do you evaluate Senator Kamala Harris's first splash, so to speak, here in Iowa?
Well, she did a couple of things that I think, are going to work in her favor. One, this was a big town hall event. It got a lot of national news. She's already been more in the national spotlight over the last year for her comments about the Trump administration for, really going after Senator, or at the time, Jeff Sessions, during his appointment to be Attorney General at the time. And then she's talking about, Medicare for all, things are going to play well with potential Democratic caucus goers. And so I think, she's starting it off as you would expect. She already has the national spotlight on her. People are excited to see her. The challenge for her now going forward is that she admitted this in the days leading up to coming to Iowa and after, is that she's going to have to be in Iowa early and often, which means she's going to have to continue to be in the state and not just hold these big town hall events that are, in this case, this was just an invite only, to actually start holding more open events, trying to the extent she can, doing kind of the living room type meetings and really get around to every corner of the state. That's how you build a successful caucus campaign, is you have to go out to the rural areas and you have to go out to the urban areas. You have to have county chairs in all 99 counties. And so this is the start of that process for her.
Mm-hmm. And we also have an interesting angle. She's got this background as a prosecutor. Right, which has, I guess, pluses and minuses when she enters this candidate crowd.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with all the decisions she made as a prosecutor or as the Attorney General with California, but from what I understand is there is some concern among potential Democrats in this process that her stance on crime, her stance on the three strikes law may turn off some voters, or it may be an issue where she has to sort of explain her position because it's somewhat out of the mainstream from what you'd expect from a more liberal Democratic base, because if she had taken a more sort of a harsher position on that particular policy.
Mm-hmm. The former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says he's also seriously He's seriously considering a White House bid. Kamala Harris actually launching that. But Howard Schultz saying his bid would be as a centrist independent. Here he is talking about that, the thoughts he has about 2020.
If there is a choice between President Trump and a progressive, liberal-minded person on the Democratic side, it would kill me to see President Trump be reelected. And I believe that's what would take place.
You but think I the Democrats are going to be too far left to win?
That's what I believe.
Okay, so that's a part of the interview with Steve Inskeep yesterday on Morning Edition. It's hard. Evan, let me throw this to you. Is it hard? I mean, an independent would be a spoiler in this case for the Democrats. Can you see it any other way?
No, I mean, I can't see either any other way. I mean, the history offers a pretty solid guide to the pattern of how these independents operate.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my only guess is he has surrounded himself with advisors who are happy to tell him things like, "You have a chance, sir. You can be the savior." And ultimately, there's no reason to believe that would be the case if history is any judge at all.
Mm-hmm.
Think about who he's potentially right siphoning off votes from. I mean, if he's running on a campaign that he's kind of talked about as being more socially liberal, if he's trying to appeal to a younger demographic, that younger demographic tends to be more likely to vote Democratic. And so I completely agree with Evan. I don't see how you see it without him being a potential spoiler for the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the candidates considering a run or having already declared their run on our way out of this hour of politics, I'd like each of you to kind of just tell us, perhaps not even a name. You could name one of those, perhaps as one you are keeping your eye on especially. But another way to answer it would be, say, what are the qualities you think in this election cycle people will be putting at the top of their list for 2020? Chris?
I'll go with the qualities. I think, number one, is relatable. Number two is a sense of trust. You get the sense that the way things are going in politics and potentially with the current administration, that a sense of relatability, sense of understanding, as well as a sense of trust and honesty, that those things have been lacking lately. And those may be the kind of the fundamental character traits that at least that Iowans are looking for in a caucus candidate. And so it goes back to your basic caucus strategy in terms of being out in front of voters and getting in front of them one-on-one and trying to connect with those voters. But I really get a sense of relatability and trust is kind of those character traits that people are looking for at this point.
Relatability and trust, says Chris. Evan, would you add, agree, disagree?
Well, I certainly would agree. And then perhaps I would just add characteristics, notions such as experience, which was a four-letter word last go-around. But perhaps after a taste of something else, we can get back to people with some experience and leadership and policy making, government positions, and perhaps that old notion of integrity, that character matters, that had fallen out of favor. It doesn't really matter the individual's character. I just want to see what he or she can do for me. So perhaps experience and integrity might be important attributes moving forward.
Mm-hmm. When we look at this, Chris, you wanted to jump in?
No, I think that's right. And again, these elections always go in kind of waves. You swing one way, and sometimes the electorate swings too far one way, and then they have to swing back the other way. And mm-hmm. so I think the four traits that we've discussed make sense in terms of, I think the electorate feels like it maybe swung too far one way, and now it's trying to correct for that.
What about the Democratic Party? Can you see any discernible move for the party as a whole between 2016 and 2020? Chris?
Well, I think they're still trying to work that out. I think they're trying to work out the type of candidate that's going to appeal to obviously the broadest portion of the electorate. But I think on the four traits that we've identified, I think that's where the Democratic Party is looking for, because you think back to 2016 and there was some concern within the party about, the relatability at the time of Senator Hillary Clinton there. Now, there were stories that, one-on-one and in small groups, she was great. It was just that there were times where she came off as not possessing some of those traits. And so I think that
you think about 2016 and those four traits that we just mentioned would seem to be where the Democratic Party is going. I think they're just trying to feel out each of the candidates that have started to come to Iowa.
Okay, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, and his colleague Evan Renfro, assistant professor of political science at UNI. Chris and Evan, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, and if I could, I also wanted to congratulate Evan. We just found out he won the Outstanding Teaching Award for UNI just the other day.
Wow, congrats, Evan.
Well, thank you, Ben. And Chris, I'll be seeing you soon. And there'll be some payback right. for that.
All right. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.